Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com. Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Dominic Fifield of The Guardian and Tom Hopkinson of The Sunday Mirror. A big week for Chelsea, a pivotal Champions League game on Wednesday when they'll be confronted by Atletico Madrid and the spirit of Diego Costa. Then there's a little matter of Manchester City at the Bridge on Saturday. Season defining, Dom?
Well, I think we'll know a lot more about Chelsea's squad strength by the weekend and whether they've got the capabilities of competing on two fronts, because I think that was always a concern with Conte, even towards the end of last season. He wondered whether they had the depth within that squad. And I think that was obviously why he agitated so much over the summer in terms of the transfer policy. So this will show us, basically. It's a massive test in Spain. Regardless of the fact that Diego Costa will no doubt be in the crowd and will draw the camera's focus, that is a proper test out on the pitch. And then to follow that up with, after an away game in Europe, with the visit of Manchester City to the Bridge, a City team who just can't stop scoring at the moment, properly daunting. But Conte will see it as a challenge that he probably feels that they can address well.
Let's look at Wednesday, first of all, Tom. Atletico Madrid have always been talked about as potential Champions League winners. Is this the season we see them maybe go to the ultimate step?
The word maybe is, yeah. I mean, you know, there's every chance. They've got as good a chance as anyone of going all the way in the Champions League, second in La Liga at the moment behind Barcelona. And, you know, what I love about Diego Simeone's teams is that they really do play in the spirit of the manager himself. You know, they've got that firebrand personality, but they're very, very talented footballers as well.
Costa will be a perfect fit.
Yeah, I mean, well, he's the prodigal son, isn't he, for Simeone. But, you know, it was interesting listening to Thibaut Courtois' comments about him. You know, he was a ray of sunshine in the dressing room, was, I think, the phrase that he used with Costa. And, you know, I think it's the perfect fit for him. I don't think anyone should forget what he achieved when he was over here with Chelsea, you know, helped them win two Premier League titles, gave a lot of entertainment, whether you loved or hated the way he played the game. You know, it was pure theatre for everyone. And I think he will be a great fit for them. So if they don't win it this season, they'll go close. If they go on next season with Costa fully in there, I mean, I know he'll get to play for the second half of this season, but, you know, with him in their ranks fully settled back into life in Madrid next season as well, I think certainly over the next two or three seasons, we'll see them go all the way.
Mm. How do you see Chelsea developing, Dom? You know, I saw them at Stoke on Saturday. Terrific going forward. Morata, you know, there were the shades occasionally of Van Nistelrooy in the way he played. Midfield, Kante never has a bad game. Bakayoko, it's huge. He's basically Yaya Toure before Yaya Toure had too much birthday cake, really. But that defence, that's the one area where they might be vulnerable?
Possibly. They have got the bodies there. They've got the quality there at the back. And Conte has moulded them into a stingy defence for periods last season. They didn't concede very many goals. I think he got his... Stoke City were shorn of some significant players.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we shouldn't get too carried away with that performance. I think perhaps more revealing was the goalless draw with Arsenal the previous week, when you actually looked at that and thought, that is an occasion when they actually missed Diego Costa. That's when Morata was up against three defenders actually trying to impose themselves physically on him. And he didn't really have the same strength in that performance. I think he will be a brilliant player for Chelsea, and I think over time the team will adapt their play to suit him and to get the best out of him in the way that they relied so heavily on Diego Costa. But I think that's a process. It's going to take a while to adjust to that. I like their first team. I think their first team's excellent. I think that their first team, if they could pick that throughout the entire Premier League season, I think they would be pushing to retain their title. But the reality is that they've got so many games on the horizon. They're going to have to chop and change, and it's whether they cope with that disruption as well. Whether they've got the capabilities and the strength and depth, that'll be the key. Mm.
What do you think of Gary Cahill, Tom? They look a bit lumpy when he's in the team, as far as I'm concerned. Does he merit his place, or is he vulnerable?
I think that's a bit harsh, actually. I like Cahill as a player. I like him as a fella as well to deal with. You know, I mean, he's excellent.
He's very good, isn't he? Yeah.
He's excellent. And there was a game last season, and I think it was just after David Luiz came back to the side, and Cahill was penalised, and. He came out afterwards and he was absolutely furious, and I love the intensity of that interview. I wish players would come out and be a little bit more like that, because it showed a side of Gary Cahill that we don't always see, that he has got that fire in his belly. And I think we sometimes, you know, we when you're watching him for Chelsea, I think he's quite often, he's a bit more understated than John Terry ever was. Mm. And so I think perhaps we don't, I'm not saying he's as good a footballer as John Terry, because I think John was arguably the best central defender in the country for many a year. But I think because he's so understated, we perhaps don't give him, Gary Cahill, as much credit as he deserves. I mean, he's won the lot, hasn't he, with Chelsea. And I remember watching him at Bolton thinking, when he first went there from Aston Villa, thinking, why on earth have they let this lad go? He was superb on his debut for Bolton. So I think they're still, as Dom says, they've really got the bodies, Chelsea, at the heart of their defence, you know, with Christensen coming through, who looks like he'll be an incredible prospect over the years. And with Luiz, since he's come back, has looked great. Mm-hmm. Rudiger as well, looks like, you know, Conte's got this lovely situation where he can put a player in and bring him out, put him back in, and, you know, really ease them into the side in defence. Whereas with Morata, he's having to throw him straight in. To be fair, Morata's responding perfectly, but in defence, he can pick and choose his games a little bit better. So, I think we'd be ruling Cahill out too soon, and I think calling him lumpy would you know, perhaps a little unfair on him. But certainly, will he play as many games as he has done in recent seasons? Probably not, but that's because Antonio Conte can afford to rest him and choose different options for different games.
What struck me about Saturday was, one, the way that Chelsea make the system work in their favour. Stoke couldn't play Zouma because of the loan rule, which I think, I don't know what you guys think, but I think that should be scrapped.
Yeah, agreed.
Secondly, with Christensen playing, I thought it was very marked how Azpilicueta almost talked him through the game. And that, to me, is, you know, another sign of leadership. And also, with you look at Azpilicueta and the relationship that he's getting with Morata, set up 4 out of his 6 goals, he's going to be an absolute key to their season, isn't he?
Well, he's done that before with Christensen. He did it at the game at Wembley against Tottenham. When Chelsea were a club apparently traumatised by that opening day defeat to Burnley, and they were there for the taking, allegedly. And yet Christensen came in and was asked to play in the middle of the back three. David Luiz moved into midfield, and both Luiz and Azpilicueta guided Christensen through that contest. Initially, he was quite shaky, and you could tell that the nerves were gripping, but by the end of it, he was playing with the authority of somebody who'd been in the Chelsea first team for 5-6 years. We shouldn't forget that with Christensen, he has played Champions League football against, you know, Man City, Barcelona, Bayern Munich in the last few years for Borussia Mönchengladbach. So he's got a bit of experience there. He won't take a lot of coaxing from people like Azpilicueta. It's more about adjusting to the Premier League. But when you've got a player like Azpilicueta, who is so consistent, he never puts a foot wrong.
Didn't miss a minute, did he, last season?
No. In fact, when he got taken off against Karabag, it was almost outcry in the press box. Like, he's actually being brought off the pitch. I mean, how are they going to cope without him? He's someone that they completely take for granted because he is so consistently excellent. And the delivery, that diagonal ball, we saw it last year when Chelsea were up against it a bit at Palace, and he put a ball across for Diego Costa to have the only goal of the game. he's got that in his locker and he's now using it with Morata. There is an understanding there already, which is...
He did against Leicester and against Stoke.
They're clearly very close friends off the pitch, yeah, though, as well. You can see by the way they... I mean, even the way they look at each other, they almost go a bit starry-eyed when they look at each other to
see... Yeah, room boys.
Yeah, well, it is almost like that. But I think, you know, when that's good recruitment. I know Antonio Conte knew all about Morata when he signed him, but managers also look at how a player is going to fit into the team, into the squad. And he, you know, again with Costa, he obviously did fit into the squad very well. But you're never going to have any worries about integrating someone like Morata into your team, and it's paying dividends for them already, because I think he scored just about every type of goal there is now, isn't it? It's good to see him scoring with his feet finally, but he's showing that he can score with his head. He can score the left foot, the right foot, close range, a little bit further out. And, yeah, I think that balance, as Dom says, the balance that Chelsea have got at the back from Azpilicueta, who almost gives Chelsea the same sort of balance that Kompany gives Manchester City when he plays. You know, it's almost like everyone else knows where their positions on the field need to be because he has put himself in there. Yeah, absolutely. And I think Chelsea have now got that all the way through to Morata at top, which is why, you know, Saturday's game against Manchester City, it will be a big telling point of where Chelsea are, but it will be a very big telling point of where Manchester City are as well.
Mm. With Morata, you know, I think one of the, you know, the emerging narratives, horrible word, but you know, of the season is this race for the golden boot. We've got four strikers now who are scoring prolifically. Morata, Lukaku, and two others, Kane. Aguero. And yeah. Kane.
Not even got to Jesus there as well.
No.
What, Benteke, are we running?
yes. He's out of the game for 8 weeks, by which time Crystal Palace will be relegated.
Stop it, right? Behave.
So what about that whole Golden Boot race?
Well, it's a nice side issue. I mean, I've never really prioritised it myself, but I've never had a right foot. But it's amazing that the Premier League has got four players of that calibre who are capable. Each of them is probably capable of getting 25 to 30 goals very easily if they stay fit over the season. It may well be that it's, you know, at a club like Manchester City, maybe Sergio Aguero won't play as many games as a Harry Kane does at Spurs, or Romelu Lukaku. I saw him Saturday. His game is actually visibly improved already at United to when he was at Everton. He's always been this beast of a player's strength there, but he's got his hold up players and his awareness is suddenly seems to be far more.
That's what they say about when you're in a team, you know, yeah, the players lift you, don't you? When you're
I
playing
guess
with better players,
the movement, etc.,
works for you.
The best. Yeah, absolutely. But I mean, he could go on and score 30 quite easily. I mean, they've all been phenomenal, but I guess, yeah, the golden boot, it'll probably come down to who plays most in the end.
And if you were forced to put your mortgage on any of them, I still think you probably wouldn't look further than Harry Kane, because I just think, you know, he's already... We can forget August now, you know, that's out of the way. And
he's on one of those streaks again.
Well, he is. The beauty of him is, though, is that he peaks right at the end of the season as well. So if he starts getting goals early, which, you know, he's getting them now, then there's no telling how many he can go on to get by the end of the season. But I think, again, with Harry Kane, it'll come back to we really want to see him now do it on the European stage as well, so that going into the World Cup at the end of the season, we know that when he's in a big game against a Germany, a Spain or an Italy, we're confident that he can do it on that level as well, because there's absolutely no doubt that he is an absolute star in the Premier League.
Mm. With City, are we seeing Pep's philosophy now really taking shape, the vision becoming clearer?
Yeah, you'd imagine so, and we should be after 14 months in the job, really.
I thought you were going to say after all the millions he spent as
and,
well.
And the hundreds of millions he spent, yeah. They are playing... Well, I'm wary of praising them to the hilt. I mean, they have been wonderful to watch so far, but this time last year we were doing exactly the same thing, and we got hoodwinked into thinking that they were going to wipe the floor with everybody, and they didn't. They hit a wall, and it's really... I think that they're obviously a better, more rounded squad now. They've got more options. They've got better options at the back. They've got this unbelievable front six, seven, eight, who can do whatever they want if they you know, the rhythm's up on the game. But let's see how they do after they've confronted a Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, after they've played a Mourinho a very much a Mourinho-style Manchester United at Old Trafford or even at the Etihad.
On the back of Champions League games
on
as
the
well.
Back of, the absolutely, absolutely. And I suppose, I mean, I guess their Champions League group isn't the most daunting, really. There'll be a trip to Donetsk, I think they're in that group, aren't they? So,
yeah.
But other than that, and United isn't actually daunting at all. It's Chelsea that have got the tricky ones and Spurs and Liverpool. So even then, I just want to see them go head-to-head with one of the elite teams, and then we'll judge how good they are.
I think that you touched on it, though, Dom. I mean, the two full-backs that they've got now in Walker and Mendy, I mean, they just they're an upgrade. There's no other way to look at it. On players who were very good but were past their sell-by date. And so that, having those two either side of you, and Danilo looks very good as a replacement as well.
Well, it was interesting on Saturday against Palace that it seemed that Pep was just doing a little bit of experimentation the last 20 minutes. Games won, moves Walker into the centre of the defence just to see how it went.
Yeah, and why not when you so clearly have the game wrapped up. But I think what I was going to say, that when you've got the fullbacks like that, you it's going to breed confidence into the likes of John Stones and even Otamendi this season. A player who we know has got a rick in him or two ricks in him every game, looks far more comfortable on the ball now than he ever has done. And I think that's breathing itself the way through the team, and it can only be a positive for Manchester City fans to see that happening.
That said, for 44 minutes on Saturday against the worst team in the league at the moment, they couldn't find a way through. And okay, Palace fell to pieces afterwards when they were presumably exhausted, having been given the runaround for most of that first.
But isn't that perfect?
Let's see what happens when a Mourinho team goes, or a Conte team. Conte's teams won't fall away like Palace did. Mm. They won't be more open in the 75th minute, but still 0-0 than Palace were. They won't fall into the traps of chasing a game. So will that front six be able to, revel in the way that they've been able to?
But the game might be a little bit more, not necessarily against Manchester United, but against Chelsea, the game might be a little bit more open for City to find spaces to exploit as Chelsea come on to them.
Chelsea went to Spurs and closed them down. That was how they won that game. They played on the counter-attack. Mm. Chelsea could do that against City. At Stamford Bridge, even.
Well, that's where the pace of a Hazard will come in handy. Mm. You'd get the sense that he's just going up through the gears as the season progresses.
Yeah, I mean, wonderful player. But who would you rather have in your side at the moment, Eden Hazard or Leroy Sané? I mean, this is how good both sides are. They've got... You'd really struggle, wouldn't you, to pick an 11 out of the two sides together. And yes, Hazard's coming back. He's had a bit of a break. And he's working his way back up through the gears. But yeah, I just wonder whether there is a bit of a baton going to be passed over in the next couple of weeks as we see City move away and Chelsea perhaps stumble a little bit. Because I mean, when you look at either side's front sort of four and five players, there's a fag paper between the two of them, isn't there, in terms of talent and terms of speed as well. So it's going to be a frightening prospect to watch them both progress and as you say, move through the gears through the course of the season.
Where do you think Raheem Sterling fits into all this, if at all? There's still all this talk about going to Arsenal and another. On the other side, they're saying he's going to sign a new contract at City. It does seem difficult for him to get a place there.
But then Raheem Sterling is the guy who came up with a late equaliser against Everton at the Etihad, who came up with a late winner at Bournemouth, scored twice on Saturday. At the moment, he's pretty much proving key. He's getting them out of tricky situations in a team that have otherwise been wiping the floor with everybody. That he was the one that saved them in those two earlier occasions. I think he's learning. I think he's getting better. Because he's an England player. Maybe we look at it and think, maybe he's not progressing as much as a Leroy Sané or a Jesus. But actually, I think his contribution is there. It's very obvious. I think Pep Guardiola, when he's spoken about him, particularly in the wake of the whole Arsenal swap deal suggestions, said that this is a player with a future at my club and I want him here.
It depends what he wants, though, doesn't it? Because I don't see that future at Manchester City as being a regular starter. I mean, if you've got, your Sanés, your David Silva, your Bernardo Silva...
Sané's not a regular starter.
No, I know, absolutely. But if you've got all of, those players, I think we'd all probably agree that they're ahead of Raheem Sterling in the grand scheme of things? And, you know, does he think that by joining an Arsenal, for example, and maybe playing in that 10 role, which he has looked quite well suited to the 10 when he's played there for City this season, might just give him more of an opportunity to progress. And he needs to keep playing at this stage of his career.
Mm. Does Dom have a point when he talks about the England factor? I'm thinking now of Stones, where he's gone through that boom and bust cycle very, very quickly, hasn't he? Yeah. He's coming back now, was it 4 games on the trot now? What do you think of that? Are we too harsh in dealing with young English players?
English players, not necessarily. I think we have with Harry Kane, you know, he's always had great credit when since he's been playing first team football for Tottenham. I think maybe we are with England players a little bit in terms of, I mean, we've watched Raheem Sterling play against Malta and then Slovakia in recent weeks, and he wasn't good. You know, didn't play well, and so, you know, you can only judge play. I mean, these aren't teams that Raheem Sterling should be having bad games against. You know, he should be taking teams like that apart. I suppose people will say, you know, Manchester City fans listening will say, well, none of the rest of the team had particularly good games in either of that as well. So there probably is an England factor in it, but I don't think it's one that we should get carried away with, because I just think you can look at Raheem Sterling's career and say he hasn't yet lived up to the potential. You know, we're not just judging him on that purely because he's English.
Mm. One person who will probably not be playing for England in the next couple of weeks is Dele Alli, simply because of the finger gate. What about the way that he is developing at Tottenham? You know, the relationship between him and Kane is fantastic, isn't it? You saw that again at West Ham.
Yeah. Well, again, there's been criticism on the back of that performance, a winning performance, and a game where he set up the first goal in particular. But sometimes the play breaks down with him. The attacking play, there's an opportunity there, and he's not dawdling on it, but he's not quite on the same wavelength as some of those around him. And you know, you're sensing now a little bit of a, ooh, is he actually progressing as much as we want him to? Where is his best position? Is he, you know, should he be sitting deeper with Spurs and bombing forward from deep and in a sort of Frank Lampard-esque way, or playing as a 10 or even out wide? I think that we're in danger with Dele Alli of expecting him to be a world beater already, and he's 21.
21, yeah.
What he's done so far at Spurs is fantastic, and in fact, I don't think he's not making it easy for us to not think like that, because with all the stuff about his agent changing and the sort of implications of that, you know, is this a move to facilitate a move to an elite club, another elite club, a Real Madrid, a Manchester United, something like that? While that is sort of floating around the ether, you know, people will expect him to perform like a player who should be playing at Real Madrid or at Manchester.
But isn't that the essence of being a successful modern sportsman, that you have to put all those pressures, all those expectations into a little box and forget them and get out there and do what you should be doing?
Of course, but we're judging him. You know, let's look at Dele Alli's Premier League career as a whole and say he is well ahead of where you would expect your average 21-year-old footballer to be. Even your average 21-year-old Premier League footballer is ahead of them. But we're looking at 6 or 7 games in isolation at the start of this season when he hasn't necessarily been at the top levels of his game. And you do wonder whether there is, you know, whether there are things going on off the field with the whole change of representation that maybe is clouding his head a little bit. But I think if we get to Christmas and Dele Alli still isn't performing to the levels that we saw from him last season, then we can start to question him. But I just think it's very normal for a player of his age to maybe take 2 or 3 steps forward and take 1 back and then go again. And I think we should be quick not to expect too much from him.
Tottenham have got a pretty gentle week. They're in Cyprus for the Champions League, then they're at Huddersfield. How much should they be worried about the fact that Moussa Dembélé seems to be struggling with that foot injury?
Well, if he'd gone back a week, it would have looked like a proper problem, because he does seem so key to them, and he's sort of the dynamism and that Spurs, when the Spurs are at their best, he sort of personifies that, the strength and movement. But actually, on the back of... I never thought I'd say this.
You're really building up to this as well, aren't you? I know where you're going.
Sissoko was a revelation at West Ham. Sissoko. Yeah. You know, a player that we'd all written off, and with good reason. And, you know, Newcastle fans thought they could not believe the fee they generated when they sold him to Spurs. And finally, we're seeing the player that illuminated the finals of the European Championship.
I'm not having that. The thing for me is, I can't say what I've just said about Dele Alli, that we shouldn't judge him on six games, and we should be saying that Sissoko, after one good game, finally one good game in a Tottenham shirt, is a world-class footballer.
He's not going to get tested against Apoel in midweek. No. And Huddersfield, OK, Huddersfield have been done really well.
But, yeah, but there will be stronger challenges for him, agreed. Mm. But Dembele is going to be, absolutely right, he's going to be a major loss to any side. You know, if you have Dembele and Wanyama in your ranks and they're not available to you, then you're going to be pained by that. Mm.
You saw Liverpool, didn't you, at Leicester on Saturday? How's the Coutinho rehabilitation?
So I saw what I like to call Liverpools, because they are two sides. They're a side who is just unbelievable going forward, and as we all know, a side who are shaky at the back, and we saw that again at the weekend. And I have to say, I sat here over the summer and said, just sell Coutinho, take the money, £136 million. And I still think it was a very good offer, that from Barcelona. I still think if I'd have been in charge and I'd got a player saying,
especially as I'm told that Barcelona were actually more interested in Christian Eriksen.
Well, yeah, there you go. So if the opportunity to bank 130, 140 million isn't going to come around again in either January or next summer, more likely, then perhaps they've missed out. But I have to say, he was superb on Saturday against Leicester. It was almost like he was just playing a different game to everybody else on the field around him, particularly in the first half. But there were times as well in the second half, you know, the cross for Mo Salah's goal was just superb. You know, I think I watched two or three replays of it and wondered if Kasper Schmeichel was badly positioned for it. But I just think the pace that Coutinho put on the cross had just caught him out. And, was, you know, you just have to, sometimes, rather than being critical, you just have to say someone's done very, very well. I mean, the free kick as well that he scored, I know it looked like there was a slight deflection off Harry Maguire's head. But again, brilliant. But there were a couple of times as well where he was just dancing his way through three or four Leicester players, and you know, it's almost that way. I know, particularly on the late games, any evening, sometimes, you know, you watch a bit of the game and then you get down to writing and then you watch a bit more. But you're almost like, you know what, I'm just going to close my laptop for a few minutes and watch Coutinho here because he was that good.
Mm. What about the defence?
What defence?
Yeah, exactly. Jurgen Klopp says he could write a book about defending in 2 hours. Wouldn't mind that type of talent, I have to say. What's he need to do there?
I think, on the basis that Sacco has left, and he was actually probably the best natural defender, and he left for his own reasons, whatever. It has to be work. It has to just be constant drilling. I think he could probably take it for granted that front six are going to run riot, whatever he does.
So in other words, playing the opponent's
just,
half.
Well, you could. But I would just work the defenders all week. That's literally just me getting, just dictate what they're doing. And if he genuinely thinks that he knows the answers on how to make them stronger, then just do it. Let one of your other coaches go off and deal with the front six.
You can only assume when they create the match situations that Coutinho, Salah, Firmino and co are just running Lovren and Matip ragged, and they're just destroyed of confidence when they get, because
all the alternatives that just don't bother.
It's such a strange situation to see from them.
Are they missing Nathaniel Clyne, who's been injured, and you know, I think his consistency is overlooked.
Yeah,
and James Milner basically doesn't want to play at left back anymore. Are they missing those two as well?
To a degree, but even when they were in the sides, you know, they still had these problems over the last few years. It's just a perennial problem for Liverpool that they can't seem to get right. I mean, Alexander-Arnold has looked good when he's come in. Gomez has looked good when he's come in, but it's just the mistakes that seem to be happening far too often. And
11 goals in six matches.
Yeah, I mean, what strikes me as being very strange about it was that, you know, look, the Van Dijk situation, it's not like they didn't have plenty of time after that had all blown up to go out and identify another defender. And Klopp must have had three or four players, as we all know, you know, the managers have the list, don't they? Must have had three or four defenders on a list to try and sign in the summer. Now, when Van Dijk fell through, Why didn't he go and buy? There must be someone out there who's an upgrade on Dejan Lovren and Joel Matip.
Do you think these guys are bad players? I look at, if you took Matip in isolation,
but it almost doesn't matter whether they're good players or bad players, because they didn't do it last year.
But they're being punished, it seems to me, from individual error under pressure. Just individual error. Now, you can work them all week. You know, that's what you know, Italian coaches do all the time, don't they? It's just repetition.
And not legislate
but
for that, yeah.
If they're not switched on there, you've got a problem.
But don't you... I mean, David Luiz came back to Chelsea as a laughing stock, and Antonio Conte got him under his wing and made him into the defender he is today. And a proper defender. If you've got that ability as a coach to instill discipline, you should be able to do that. I don't think Matip's a bad player individually. I don't think Lovren's a bad player individually.
But I'd
question whether Van Dijk, if they spent £60 odd million on him, got him, put him in that Liverpool defence, whether we'd be sitting here thinking, oh, they've spent a lot of money on a player that's not very good. Because I imagine the same problems would grip him. Because I think it's an issue with the collective. Mm. It's how he's coaching the lot of them.
No, I'm not certain about that. I mean, I would say about Luiz, I think he left. He probably left Chelsea a bit of a laughing stock.
He was a laughing stock at PSG.
Was he?
I mean, the last season at PSG, when they sold him to Chelsea, journalists and Le Parisien and L'Equipe were saying, "Poof, what have Chelsea done here?" Because he's not the player he was.
That's interesting. I mean, when I saw him, I mean, he admitted playing against Chelsea, so he probably raised his game. He looked superb again. But yeah, I just with Van Dijk, Lovren, when we saw him at Southampton, did look a very, very good defender, very strong, very solid. And it has gone downhill for him at Liverpool, but I still think Van Dijk would be an upgrade on him.
You saw Klopp afterwards. What was his mood like? Is this getting to him a bit?
Yeah, it was interesting. I wasn't actually in the press conference directly afterwards, so I only saw the TV interview with him. But I did see him when he came out and of the main press briefing, and he was going to do a briefing with the Daily Papers for the follow-up for Monday's newspapers, and he didn't want to do it. He didn't want to be answering those questions. He did do it. He stopped and he spoke to them, but he clearly wanted to be away and presumably wanted to be working on how on earth he can... I mean, look, he's not going to... I mean, he was in the briefing with the Daily Papers, actually, that he talked more about the defensive side of things and about writing, you know, that he could write the book, and I'm telling them. And, I mean, he must be, as you say, headbutting brick walls because, you know, we saw at Dortmund, he could do the defensive side of the coaching. So whatever it is, whatever it's not sticking at Liverpool, I just don't know.
Is that a contrast to Jose Mourinho's current mood?
That performance on Saturday, I was lucky enough to be at Southampton, and that was a Mourinho team lifted out of the mid-noughties. You go back 13 years to Chelsea. It was the strength and power that he's got up and down that spine is frightening. And he's almost achieved it overnight. And that's a team without Pogba as well. He's got Phil Jones playing out of his skin. Eric Bailly looks a fantastic centre-half again. The midfield, even Fellaini's transformed. Matic, I know people made a big thing about Matic leaving Chelsea, and I do think Chelsea will regret that. But not that they lost him, because I think Bakayoko, as you said earlier, is a fantastic player and will fill that void. But to give him to United and allow them to benefit from what he can bring into a team, something else. Lukaku, strong. Even Mkhitaryan looks a different player. He's got Rashford tackling back. First half of that game Saturday, they looked as if they were going to win 4-0. They were wiping the floor with Southampton. Every time they went forward, they looked as if they were scoring. Second half, Southampton were fantastic and they battered United and there was no way through. And that, to me, is a Mourinho team that is all the old ingredients. It's everything we saw at Chelsea first time round, even a bit second time round. He had played five at the back for the last 20 minutes and he just said, try and get through this, and they couldn't.
He's a master at winning ugly, isn't he?
He is, yeah. I mean, not just in the Premier League, he'll do it in Europe as well. He's just a pragmatist, isn't he? You know, and I don't say that with any, you know, in any detrimental way towards him, because you only have to look at everything he's achieved in the game, all the trophies he's won, the honours he's won. You know, sometimes you have to win ugly, don't you? You know, you can. It's great to watch.
But those were the games that they were drawing last year, weren't they?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, yeah. And yeah, as Dom says, it's, you know, I mean, it's certainly over the summer, just by the signings that he made, and that's again, you know, if you remember when he brought Costa in, they knew that deal was happening sort of January, February time, didn't they? It was a long run up to Costa coming in over the summer, and that's what Mourinho did well last year. He even though, even you know, in the white hot heat of the Premier League, he identified very quickly the four players and the four positions that he needed to strengthen in the summer and went out and did it.
Do you think they'll strengthen again in January? Let's talk about Fabinho. I think Mesut Ozil's put his hand up. Please, sir, can I come and join you?
Yeah, he seems to be doing that a lot at the moment, doesn't he?
You know, Paulo Dybala
as well, yeah.
Any relevance in those rumours?
Yeah, I mean, Dybala, I think, he's one for next summer, isn't he? And if you've got Zlatan Ibrahimovic coming back, I don't see why they would need, you know, particularly given the
started way... Started fantastic, was it 10 well, in 6 Serie A games?
Yeah, I mean, clearly an absolute goal machine as well. But why, you know, given the way that not just Lukaku started, but Martial, Rashford as well, and then with Ibrahimovic coming back into that side, I don't think Manchester United... I don't think there's any need, really, to mix the squad up at all this January. I don't think that any new bodies coming in just to sort of, you know, unbalance things at all are needed. But I certainly think next summer, I mean, Mourinho, he does it wherever he goes, doesn't he? You know, he'll want at least two new players in just to freshen things up and hopefully take them to the next level again.
Mm. Arsenal. Arsene Wenger is in, I didn't fancy him much anyway, mode. Yeah. Champions League, not interested anymore. By the way, you're not in it.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, he is missing it, isn't he? He's clearly missing it quite a lot. Again, it's difficult to judge Arsenal because I thought they were very impressive at Chelsea. I thought they showed a new side to their game almost, a bit of steel. I mean, Mustafi wouldn't have been able to do what he did that afternoon if Costa had been playing against him, admittedly, but I thought that the back three actually worked that day. It didn't have enough to win it, but it was a buoyant, a good performance and a good point. But then you want to judge them how they follow that up. Do they you know, beat West Bromwich Albion in a swashbuckling way on the Monday night subsequently? Because that's a very different kind of test to going to Stamford Bridge. And it's not always the type of game that brings the best out of Arsenal. I just think Arsenal are where they are. I think that they'll challenge for a while to get into the top four, but I'd be surprised if come the end of the season they're in it. Mm.
And it is a reality check. Bate Borisov away from home on a Thursday night.
Yeah.
Do you think he'll change the team?
Oh, undoubtedly, yeah. I mean, it's perfect for the youngsters that Arsene Wenger has got at his availability. And I think rightly so. I mean, you know, look, it's not going to make a difference. They might do what Manchester United did last season and not take it seriously until after Christmas. And then if things aren't looking good in the Premier League in terms of reaching the top four spots, and they're still in the Europa League, yeah, and they get a favourable draw, they may just say, do you know what, let's take a run at this and we can win it. But again... The FA Cup. What always made me laugh with the Arsenal fans was that they demanded silverware, and then when he won the FA Cup a couple of years, they said, well, actually, no, we meant the Premier League. And I think the Europa League will be the same for them. I think it would, you know, be a good couple of days away to paper over a few cracks for a few weeks until the next league game comes around at the start of next season, and we're back to square one, which is Arsenal fans just not having Wenger anymore.
Ties in quite nicely with one of the questions we're getting in from the listeners and the viewers. Gordon Maxwell asked, was Wenger right that something will happen in the next 12 months to control transfer fees?
Well, UEFA have sort of tried that with financial fair play, really, and that's just fallen by the wayside. I'm actually inclined to think that it will go the other way and that the big clubs who can go out there and spend £150 million on a player will spend even more. And, you know, the clubs that will actually suffer will be those in the middle, really. Mm. He just can't afford that and can't compete. I can't see any control. I don't see who would impose a control.
I think Wenger, he's very good, actually, and particularly nowadays, I don't know how you find him, Don, but particularly nowadays, he's almost better talking about situations and topics like this rather than actually talking about what goes on the football field, because he almost doesn't want to get involved with that. But what he said...
I had about 20 minutes with him last week, and he was fascinating on youth development.
He's an incredible person to talk to about the bigger picture of... I mean, even about football as well, I think, but the bigger picture of football, I find him really interesting. But I think what he said about the whole transfer situation is that, look, we're in this sort of weird middle ground at the moment, and they need to go one way or another. They either need to implement financial fair play rules that completely rule out these ludicrous, which, let's face it, they are crazy astronomical figures, or we just need to forget about it altogether and say, look, you're just free to spend whatever you want and we're going to have to deal with the consequences.
Laurie McGinley's been on after watching Manchester City. He said they were excellent at the weekend, but Pep says he wanted more out of them. Is he just looking for perfection?
Isn't that what every manager's looking for, really?
Most of them don't talk to the ball boys about it, do they?
No, nice of knowing exactly what he was saying. I imagined it was to try and get the ball back in play, because at that point Palace were wheezing and didn't know what was going on. Is he after perfection? Well, yeah, of course he is, yeah. He came with a massive reputation last season. I imagine it stung him as it disappointed every Manchester City fan out there. It wasn't what it had been billed. So far, so good this season. He looks as if he's taken it to another level. But let's see where we are in April.
I think what's interesting with Guardiola, when you talk about the perfection, if you'd said that to me a year ago, I'd have thought, well, that's just ridiculous. You know, you're never, ever going to get it. You might get it in patches, but you're never going to get it across the course of a season. But then I look what he's done with Sergio Aguero, who I thought was perfection as a striker a year ago, but he actually almost seems to have improved his game. He's more rounded now, I think, and still scoring the goals as well. So, perhaps he's right to be in search of it.
But what is perfection? Is it every chance you create, you score?
Yes.
Well, good luck with
good
that.
Good luck with that. Yeah. And it's a funny old game management. Actually, we've got Phil Brackenridge is asking, will Eddie Howe be given time at Bournemouth?
Yes.
Does he deserve time at Bournemouth?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course he does. Of course he does. He absolutely does. And you'll get it. I don't get any sense that there's agitation there. They've had a bad start, but they're a point of safety. It's missing.
What about in March, if they're still... I mean, I agree. I think
Bournemouth go down.
It's always too late in March.
All right, yeah, but I just mean, what about January, February time then? Yeah. Whenever is the time to get the bounce by bringing in a new... I mean, I completely agree with Dom. He has everything he's done for that club. And let's not pretend that they're little Bournemouth without a penny. You know, they are a very wealthy club and very well backed. So, but that's not to take away from the job that Eddie Howe has done with them and this sort of identity that is created down there and the way he gets them to play football. But I just wonder if, come January, February, March, if they're still in the mire, it's very interesting then to see what very rich, very powerful people do and how they behave and how they react when threatened with the idea of losing significant amounts of money.
Yeah, it's fair. I mean, there are... You know, that's a very valid point, and we don't know what the Russian would think. There are questions that should be asked of Eddie Howe, definitely, and a few of them were asked last season about the transfer policy and the fact that the people who were doing so well in his team were arguably the guys that had come up through the divisions with him, and he knew the style. Whenever he spent big money on a player, it didn't seem to work out for whatever.
Jordan Ibe and people.
Jordan Ibe was one, yeah, absolutely. And I think you could maybe argue the same on Jermaine Defoe this year,
particularly when King was playing so well at the end of last season.
Exactly,
yeah.
And it does require a change of style slightly, a tweak of style to integrate Defoe into that team. So there are questions being asked of him, but it would be a waste if they didn't build on a ninth place finish, but is he under... I mean, he's not going to get the sack, is he? Not unless the Russian does something daft.
No. Tony Waters has been on with... wants us to look at an area which is the bane of any manager's life, diving.
Yeah.
He said the risk and reward equation is in favour of the diver as things stand. But if there was punishment for exceeding X number of dives, and that was a points deduction, would managers tell their players, don't dive?
You're absolutely right. I mean, an X number of dives, by the way, should be one. If I thought Sean Dyche was excellent when
he spoke. What, you take points away for one dive?
If a player... Oh, sorry, I mean, probably not that, but I thought you meant... Well, no, I thought what you meant was in a game, you know, if someone's going to get penalised rather than necessarily a points deduction for that. But if I would certainly give a player a three-match ban for a dive, or even, you know, let's take it to another level and say, look, you're proven to have dived four matches. The only way you're going to stop players doing this is by taking the ball away from the child, or by hitting them in the pocket. And only if clubs start getting hit in the pocket, or whether it's, you know, a points deduction for, I don't know, let's say five dives, or if we've proven 5 to 10 dives, whatever that figure should be, then that's the only way that managers are really going to clamp down on it, because Tony's absolutely right. While ever there isn't that risk of being, you know, penalised, you might lose a player for, you might get a player booked or whatever, but you're only going to miss him then, even if ends up getting sent off, you're only going to miss him for one game for two bookables. So, yeah, you're absolutely right about the risk and reward.
Jim Benton-Evans, how can the fans or the media persuade owners to challenge increasing control freakery from the Football League? In other words, he's talking about the transfers, the Checkatrade trophy, the general drift towards a system which is dominated from top to bottom by the Premier League.
How can they challenge it? Well, they can protest at their level, at the local level, I guess, to get their club chairman going to these meetings and lodging complaints, but I don't think that will necessarily do anything. The reality is that the Premier League... we're talking about the Football League, but the reality is the Premier League are almost dictating everything that happens. The Premier League imposes a transfer deadline at the end of the summer before the first game, and suddenly the Football League follows suit. The Football League would deny it, but they're under the thumb, aren't they? I mean, they have to follow suit. That then becomes an issue that all fans can empathise with. Fans don't have a say. Fans can't really impose their will on big bodies like the Premier League, or the Football League, which are commercially driven.
It used to depend how much you cared about it as well, because if you really cared, you could say, well, let's all not go to a game or whatever. But unfortunately, there's so much money in the game now that the only way, you know, of course, we all know that one of the reasons the British game sells so well globally is because of the packed stadiums, and that's not going to look good if all of a sudden teams are playing to, you know, to 20 people. But there's so much money, the game is so awash with money these days that it's not even going to hit owners in the pocket if people don't turn up.
A final question, and it's probably a question that would take us several hours to answer, but we've only got about a couple of minutes. The FA, what do we do about them?
Several hours.
Yes.
I want to say FA. I don't know, it's... There are good people who work within the FA, we should say that.
And you talk to them privately and they're tearing their hair out.
Yeah, they despair. Mm. It's some of the self-inflicted damage is astonishing. And it has been for years. And we can go back to, I don't know, Gay Hillsborough, even, you know, way back, we're calling 30 years back. It's just one thing after another. And the Sampson affair now is the latest focus, but... I don't know. I don't have an answer for a reform. Maybe the government has to get involved. Maybe the government has to impose some kind of level of reform. But then, you know, in every other walk of life,
take away their funding. Take away their official funding.
Yeah, I mean, look,
and the Premier League will just step into the breach.
Yeah, the problem for me, the Football Association have, is that they have to be squeaky clean now, and there's no leeway. I mean, let's look back a year ago to when Sam Allardyce was sacked. You know, I didn't think at the time when listening to him, he said that there are ways around certain issues in the game, but he didn't actually say, and this is how you do it. He just said, look, everyone knows how you do it, and that's what it is. And yet the FA were almost forced to react so quickly that they had to take the decision to sack him. And I think, again, in this, the situation with Mark Sampson, look, the whole claims of racism, they need to be investigated thoroughly and wholly, and it's a situation that needs sorting out. But the way it has all evolved, with him being dismissed for something that happened, you know, two or three years ago, and there was no illegality involved as far as we're being told.
Which they were aware of.
Then are they reacting to that now and judging? It's judging people by today's standards and, you know, judging past events. I mean, it's such a murky area. But, you know, I have to say I do have a degree, and it is a small degree, but a degree of sympathy for them on, you know, on many of these situations.
Well, it's an unholy mess. Let's face it. The FA is currently unfit for purpose. It must change or die. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Did you know that Xavi Hernandez used to scan over 8 times in the 10 seconds before receiving the ball? It's therefore not surprising that he rarely lost it. Scientific studies have shown just how important scanning is in soccer. Players who scan more, for example, make twice as many successful forward passes than those who scan less. But training this skill is difficult, and that's why thousands of players trust Be Your Best, the soccer training app in virtual reality, designed to improve players' game intelligence. To learn more, visit beyourbest.com and use code POD20 to get 20% off your first subscription.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.